Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I apologize for the temperature in the courtroom. We are trying to cool it down. We'll do our best to muddle through with the warmer than usual temperature. Our first case this morning is Linda White versus Marshall and Ilsley Bank, case number 11-2660. Mr. Klein.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. This case was dismissed on the basis of a presumption of prudence under ERISA. There are two seminal cases which form this presumption. One is Munch. It was a Third Circuit case in 1995. The other is Cooper from the Sixth Circuit in 1995. What we know now is that the Sixth Circuit is not only different, but outcome determinatively different from the Second and Eleventh Circuits, which have also adopted the Munch presumption. And the question presented is, what is the law in the Seventh Circuit? This court seems to have principally followed Cooper and should continue to follow the Sixth Circuit line of cases for the reasons explained in those cases and in plaintiffs' briefs. In essence, that they're consistent with ERISA and with general pleading rules. Appellees suggest that this court has adopted a presumption of prudence applicable to pleadings, and the district court found that this that there was a presumption of prudence applicable to pleadings that can only be overcome by a showing of dire circumstances. This court has made reference to a presumption in six cases. From the first to the most recent, those cases are Steinman, Armstrong, Summers, and Pugh, all of which cited to Cooper, the Sixth Circuit case, before citing to Munch. And Summers and Pugh both cited to Munch after Cooper and after a signal of see also. Howell cited to Summers, which cites Cooper first, before citing to Munch.
Does the sequence of citations control our decision today?
I don't believe that the sequence does control the decision.
No. Could we talk about, in essence, whether the presumption is appropriate under ERISA? M&I stock was publicly traded, right?
Correct.
Which exchange was it traded on?
I'm not positive, but I believe it was the New York Stock Exchange, but I don't know.
But it was on one of the major stock exchanges, public market, highly liquid market. We, for example, in Summers, assume that those prices efficiently reflect publicly available information about the stock and its value. So let me ask, during your proposed class period of, let's say, in 2007 or 8 or 9, would it have been prudent or imprudent for fiduciaries of other ERISA plans, let's say other big Milwaukee employers like Miller Brewing or Harley-Davidson, to have included Marshall and Ilsley stock in their plans?
In their defined contribution plans where the employees were making the decision, Your Honor?
Yeah, sure.
I believe it would have been imprudent, but those fiduciaries are differently situated, and that's part of the difference between this case and Summers against State Street.
How are they differently situated?
Because those fiduciaries are insiders at the company, and they have...
Go ahead.
In Summers, the court basically suggests it would be hubris for a committee of union persons. It was union members appointed to the committee to have tried to outsmart the market, or for State Street to try to do it. Here, the defendants are higher-ups in Marshall and Ilsley, and they have better information.
So do you think they have an obligation to trade for the benefit of the beneficiaries and participants based on that inside information?
We're not saying that they have any obligation to commit insider trading laws, but the two can be harmonized.
Please try. I don't understand that.
Okay. For example, if they had frozen the stock fund to new purchases, that wouldn't be covered by insider trading laws.
That's the Sixth Circuit's
that's
proposal.
That's the Sixth Circuit's
But wouldn't they have had to announce that?
They would have.
Because they would have been violating the terms of the plan, correct? And they would have had to announce... We believe that our stock is in such dire straits that we have to break the terms of our plan, thereby presumably launching an exodus from M&I stock by everybody, right?
I don't quite agree with that, and I think there are ways it could be done otherwise. For example, if the stock had a tremendous upside and a tremendous downside, it could be too risky for retirement savings, and it would be too risky for retirement savings, but it may be perfectly good for investment of other sorts, by less risk-averse investors.
As an investor, how would you feel if you look, your whole theory is that the insiders know better than anybody. How would you invest your stock as they're saying, we've got to get out?
I don't think that they would necessarily have to say we've got to get out. They could simply say that the downside is too likely for retirement savings of our own employees, who at the same time could also lose their job, and they're exposed to a whole lot of downsides if something bad happens to Marshall and Ilsley. At the same time, the fiduciaries could be, in certain circumstances, for example, investing their own money in the stock. We're still buying it. We're still buying it with our own money because we think it's a good investment and there's a tremendous upside. But at the same time, we think the downside for our own employees' retirement savings is simply too steep.
Has any ESOP management that you know of done this publicly ever? Publicly announced, we're not going to buy our own stock anymore.
There are stock funds that have been frozen. I know United Health froze its stock fund.
Mm-hmm. Did they announce that?
Its plan. I think they did it in 8K, Your Honor, but I can't represent.
Did their plan require them to invest in their stock?
There was a standalone ESOP, I think, which was merged into the 401, which was frozen and then merged into a 401K plan. Mm-hmm. But I can't recall those circumstances off the top of my head.
From a standpoint of prudence, what was the alternative? What should they have done?
What should the defendants in this case have done?
Yeah. No, I mean, as far as the ESOP decision, whether or not to keep their own stock, what should they have done otherwise?
Well, they could have frozen the stock fund to new purchases when the company was too risky for retirement savings.
And invest something else?
They could have disclosed and invested the monies into something else. They could have frozen
the... See, the problem I have is with the something else. As we all know, the market crashed. And there wasn't really any place to go except maybe gold and treasuries. Hindsight.
I agree that the market crashed, and when if and when we get to damages, that may be.
Well, I'm just saying what's prudent to do. When somebody says, see, because when the market went all the way down, et cetera, then this stock didn't go back up, but it went up some and just kind of leveled out. Well, it didn't go under until it was bought out. You know?
It would be prudent in a downturn, Your Honor, I would say, to diversify. And to
But diversify into what? This is the problem. See, if somebody is prescient and says, well, I'm only going to go to gold or something because that's the only thing that really went up.
Even mutual funds and diversified stock funds went down less than Marshall and Ilsley, and they exposed participants. More importantly, they exposed participants to less risk at the time.
Okay, I'm just looking at the Dow. I know there are other measures.
They did go down, but they didn't go down as much as M&I, and they weren't subject to as much risk as M&I. If I could also add, Your Honor, defendants suggest that. Plaintiffs have abandoned their artificial inflation claims on the stock fund also. In other words, the defendants knew the M&I stock fund was artificially inflated. And by...
Was that by their own purchases? Is that what it was artificially inflated?
The defendants at Marshall and Ilsley on the 401k plan knew that Marshall and Ilsley's stock fund was artificially inflated. The
price inflated by what? They're buying it?
No, inflated by the company's trouble. The company had troubles which inflated the stock price.
So are you arguing that it was or was not?
We are arguing it was. Defendants took the position in their appeals brief that by not appealing the fiduciary misrepresentation claims, I believe their position is that we've abandoned the artificial inflation claims, and we don't believe that we have. The stock can be imprudent because it was artificially inflated.
When we're trying to do the math here, could you explain your perspective on the role of the Medavanti stock and the spinoff and how we should do the calculations here?
I agree. It cuts against the losses that the participants had shares of Medavanti for a portion of the decrease in the M&I stock fund.
So the loss was a lot less than 89%.
The loss was 54%, I believe.
You agree with that?
Yes.
Before you sit down, if I could go back to something you said a moment ago, you're not arguing that the duty of prudence in this case entailed a duty to divest. It's just a duty to freeze new purchases and a duty to diversify.
But we do also argue there was a duty to divest when the stock became too risky to be held for retirement savings. I'm sorry if I misspoke.
Okay.
Let me, if I could, this is a complex case with a lot of broad consequences.
Agreed.
And frankly, one of the things that worries me about this case and others like it is the way in which they tend to put fiduciaries on a knife edge, okay? Particularly where they would have to violate the terms of a plan to comply with what you say is the term would be the requirements of prudence. Do you see in this case, was there any gray area in which you think the fiduciaries had discretion either to comply with the plan or to close M&I stock as an option?
I think there are two, Your Honor. One is that the plan itself says that ERISA trumps the plan and that the fiduciaries are bound by ERISA's duty of prudence. I understand the plan also says they have to offer the stock fund.
But, yes.
But the plan says, and I think it's a paragraph 71 of our complaint, that they're also bound by ERISA's fiduciary duty. And ERISA itself says that's part of ERISA's statutory scheme. And part of the reason that ERISA was – part of the reason Congress enacted ERISA was because fiduciaries had too much power to be locked into stock funds and to be guided by sponsors.
Okay. And that really doesn't answer my question. Let me make it more pointed. In July of 2008, during your class period, the stock price reached a low of $11.50 on July 14th. Okay? If I understand your theory, at least that would have been a time when the fiduciaries should have violated the specific instructions of the plan and closed M&I stock as an option, essentially forced people to sell. Is that right? That's what prudence required.
They should have done it at all points leading up to that.
But including that point, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Over the next 2 months, the stock price more than doubled. Went up to $23.45 on September 26th. So I'm trying to imagine what the litigation would look like by participants in the plan who said, you forced me to sell in July. You violated the terms of the plan, and as a result, I lost the opportunity to double what my value had been then. That would be a pretty good case under ERISA, wouldn't it?
To recoup some of their losses? Your Honor, I believe
or if they had just invested in July.
I believe the Summers case, to some extent, Your Honor, answers that. And it says at one point, and I believe it's on page 411, that the fiduciaries could have been sued if they had taken the road not taken. But
yes.
That the court's analysis, the analysis presented in the court's opinion would have bailed the fiduciaries out of that suit.
And this one too, right?
If the fiduciaries had done their due diligence and if they had looked and considered all the risks of M&I stock, and if they could show they had weighed the risks fairly and come to a decision. Then.
So what's missing here as far as you're concerned is a memo to the file with some expert advice saying it's okay to keep investing in M&I stock?
What's missing is we believe either they breached their duty of prudence by failing to investigate the stock fund or their duty of loyalty by not weighing what their investigation would have found, what we believe their investigation would have found properly.
And would have shown that the market overvalued the stock.
And that the stock was simply too risky for retirement savings.
Was this the only retirement plan for M&I employees?
I believe so, Your Honor. I'm not aware of another one. Would probably be more accurate.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Blocker?
Sorry, DOL.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. You had divided your time. Thank you. Ms. Minix.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Good morning.
My name is Jamila Minix. I'm here on behalf of the Secretary of Labor. Now, as the Secretary has primary enforcement authority over ERISA's fiduciary provisions, we are here today to express our views on three points. The first is that the text of ERISA's fiduciary provisions clearly provides a list of shalls and shall nots. And in this regard, the fiduciaries are bound to the duties of prudence, loyalty, and adherence to plan documents to the extent that they are consistent with ERISA. The creation of additional exceptions from fiduciary liability is thus a concept that's not supported by the text of the statute. So plaintiffs should not.
But the Munch presumption is based on trying to reconcile conflicting instructions from prudence and plan documents, right?
Well, not exactly, Your Honor. And with the Munch presumption, one of the issues with the Munch presumption, or with the Cooper presumption as it's been styled in the Sixth Circuit, is that the courts are really very diverse in the way that they apply this exception. But this is not an exception that's found anywhere within the statute.
Well, let's put it this way. What is a fiduciary in this situation supposed to do when the plan document, the market fluctuates, it's in a general risky time, and the plan documents say you must make the employer stock available?
Well, in this particular instance, Your Honor, the plan does have language that says that the fiduciaries were charged with maintaining this investment in employer stock no matter how dire the financial circumstances. Is that the provision?
Mm-hmm.
With that provision, that's the third shall that I referred to earlier, that the fiduciaries are charged with maintaining that investment or complying with plan documents in any regard, as long as that instruction is consistent with ERISA.
So in this situation or in other situations that you want to address on behalf of the Secretary, how are fiduciaries supposed to recognize when the duty of prudence, the general duty of prudence, conflicts with those specific instructions in the plan?
Well, the duty of prudence is outlined in the statute under 404A1B, and it just says that they're instructed to operate as any diligent person would operate under
and they're instructed to comply with the plan documents.
Right.
So how do they reconcile that?
Because the very end of 404A1D has that language that says that the fiduciaries may only follow these plan documents to the extent that they're otherwise
right.
consistent.
Okay. And so for Marshall and Ilsley, fiduciaries of this plan, how and when were they supposed to recognize that they were supposed to bail out of M&I stock as an investment option?
The fiduciaries in this instance, Your Honor, should have looked at the investment that they were making, which they were presumed to have knowledge of investment matters in general. And then, at a certain point, they should have determined whether it was a prudent investment for the plan. The prudence and loyalty requirements absolutely trump the plan document. So,
what was it that they missed? What were they supposed to have seen?
The in dire circumstances, Your Honor, ERISA absolutely prohibits sponsors from writing exculpatory provisions such as this into the plan document, and that's Section 410.
No. When were they supposed to see that things were so bad they had to get out?
Well, the issue there is that this is a factual issue.
Based on what facts? What are they supposed to see? This is all based on hindsight.
Right, but Your Honor, in this instance, the plaintiffs have, this is a motion to dismiss case where the plaintiffs have alleged that the defendants knew or had non-public information, A, that they knew, that they didn't disclose, and then
Does the SEC know about the position you're taking in this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is the Department of Labor advocating that ERISA requires fiduciaries to trade on inside information?
No, Your Honor.
It sounds a lot like that's what you're saying.
No, and that's not the position that we would ever take.
I would hope not, but it's to separate your position from that.
Well, the plaintiffs have raised several arguments in this case, in their complaint, for why the fiduciaries should have taken their investment out of the stock plan. One of the arguments is that the stock was overvalued. And then the other argument is that the stock continued to fall precipitously. And so
So we've got three options so far. One is hindsight that the stock kept falling and falling. Second is insider information. And the third seems to be that they're supposed to have outsmarted the market and treated the market price as irrationally high. Is that right?
That's not how we're outlining our argument, Your Honor.
Probably not, but I'd like you to explain what other alternative there is for finding liability in this case.
Well, for instance, recently the court in file in the Sixth Circuit was discussing the Cooper presumption, which this court has addressed on a number of occasions. And in file, the court said that the plaintiffs have to be permitted to produce evidence, to discover evidence that would establish that a fiduciary standing in the same position as the fiduciaries here would have made a different investment decision.
And how would that be based on something other than hindsight, inside information, or you should have outsmarted the market?
Well, it's really a factual determination, and that's where...
What facts would, even theoretically, allow that determination?
Well, the plaintiffs could, for instance, hire an expert who could discuss the market at the time and say that at this point, this is when we, in our expert opinion, would have removed the stock. I mean, but the issue, Your Honor, is that the plaintiffs haven't had an opportunity to do any of it, and so they haven't had an opportunity to put forth any of any information that suggests that proves the allegations in their complaint.
But they still have this issue, though. The whole market is falling. Sure, there are probably some here and there, but I just go by the Dow that is just on a continued slide. And even if they do an alternative, now I know they have there are 22 options, I guess, in the general whatever for people who are covered. I don't know what they are. Maybe one of them is a bond fund that may have been better to be in. I don't know. But that's we operate here in hindsight. Yeah, they should have done something else. But when you're sitting there in the chair saying we're going to make a decision that is going to be pretty impacting, based on what? Because is in hindsight, even if you're plugged into something else, even another bank, everything seemed to be going down then until I think it was January of 2009.
Your Honor, I see my time is up, but
yeah,
I'd like to address.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, that's why the court's decision in file became so instructive, as we see it, because in file, the court gave the plaintiffs an opportunity to produce evidence to show that there was something else available, that something that the fiduciaries had other alternatives. But file was also very, in our estimation, a very good case because it turned on whether the fiduciaries, whether they're ESOP fiduciaries or whether they're investment and fiduciaries in general, would have made a different investment decision. Now, that is a way to interpret Cooper as a presumption, but then it said that in order to interpret Cooper as any sort of presumption, or in order to make that interpretation, Your Honor, that the plaintiffs would have to be permitted to produce evidence to support their claims. So that's why it was inappropriate to dismiss at the pleading stage.
Would it have been appropriate for the fiduciaries to shift, to close the M&I stock fund and move that money into the S&P 500?
Your Honor, I can't stand here in the shoes of an expert and say what would have been appropriate or what would not have been appropriate.
This is one of those fields where, are you familiar with the thesis of a random walk down Wall Street and the efficient market hypothesis here, which we've adopted in Summers and in these cases for publicly traded stocks?
Yes.
So you're supposed to bring in an expert that says, I knew better than the stock market and I would have told them they should have done something differently here?
Well, Your Honor, not necessarily that they knew better than the stock market. But the issues at the pleading stage are whether the plaintiffs have plausibly alleged facts that support their claims. And in this case, the plaintiffs have plausibly alleged that the stock was inflated and that the fiduciaries had an obligation then to remove it from the plan. And so I understand your question, if I'm understanding your question correctly, about the efficient markets and whether the fiduciaries should have known better than the market. But the question, that is a question that can be posed to an expert. So it's an issue that I think and that we think needs further discussion.
Does the Secretary see any risk that these sorts of cases and the uncertain legal standards that they impose will effectively undermine ESOPs?
Well, if not, we don't see this as undermining
ESOPs. By making the fiduciaries essentially guarantors of good performance?
We don't see this, Your Honor, as undermining ESOPs because Congress, when it created ESOPs and when it permitted ESOPs, gave ESOPs tax treatment. They exempted ESOPs from the diversification requirement. So they provided ESOP fiduciaries with the cover that they intended to provide them with.
What you're saying, though, is that in a serious downturn, fiduciaries will be on the hook for billions of dollars if a judge is persuaded by an expert with the benefit of hindsight that they should have done something different. Is that right?
Well, if the fiduciary acted improperly, imprudently, then
by failing to outsmart the market.
No, not by failing to outsmart the market, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Now, Mr. Blocker.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Blocker on behalf of the appellees. May it please the Court. I want to start with the questions that you were asking, Judge Hamilton, because I think it really gets to the nub of what this case is about. As you know from the record in this case, the fiduciaries, the Marshall and Isley fiduciaries overseeing the plan, knew one thing for sure, and that was that the plan mandated that they invest in Marshall and Isley stock. The plan couldn't be any clearer in that regard that was an obligation. It's unambiguous in the plan. Now, to be sure, it's not an obligation that without limits, but it's a substantial obligation. Our obligation is to follow the plan documents.
So where's the limit?
Well, the cases, Your Honor, like Pew and Howell have tried to sketch some outlines of where they think the limit is. But what this case is really about is when is the fiduciary required to breach that obligation? And the answer to your question about where the limit is, there ought to be some sort of very compelling circumstances existing that the fiduciary can see that causes the fiduciary to want to divest from the stock. Because absent that, if you have what you have in this case, and all that's alleged in this case is really just some market downturn, the stock price took a 50% downturn, which, by the way, wasn't that much different than what you saw in the market as a whole in 2008. But all you really have is some stock market declines and some trouble at Marshall and Isley. This company was never in any threat of going bankrupt. It was a perfectly sound company throughout the entire time.
Well, on the subject of the limiting principle, then the district court made a mistake in requiring, or at least appearing to require, impending collapse, and that's not supported by our cases. It can be something other than impending collapse.
The court has actually articulated in a number of its cases different standards. There are different ways you could find that a fiduciary would have an obligation to divest. But the one thing we know for sure doesn't create an obligation to divest is simply if you see stock market, a price decline, and some market turbulence related to the company. That can't be enough. And so whatever the standard is, whether it's impending collapse or dire circumstances, whatever it is, it wasn't met in this case. But to answer Judge Hamilton, to answer your question, it has to be something that is so severe, something that it's crystal clear to the fiduciaries that no reasonable fiduciary would continue to invest in the stock. There can't be any debate. It has to be something that's extremely severe. And you don't have that in this case, and that's the problem.
Well,
but the Department of Labor...
If you grant some ability to break the plan, why doesn't that turn this into a question for evidence rather than a question to be resolved on the pleadings?
Well, that's why there is this presumption of prudence that has been applied.
Well, not many folks have applied it at the pleading stage.
Well, Your Honor,
the Second Circuit has recently.
The Second, the Third, and the Eleventh have all applied it at the pleading stage. I would submit to Your Honor that's exactly what happened in Pugh versus Tribune. There was a motion to dismiss. Prudence was raised. These exact same arguments got vetted. And this court said at the pleading stage that there was no evidence of imprudence. So while the court may not have said, well, we're going to apply the Mensch presumption at the pleading stage, it's exactly the same sort of analysis that you see from cases like Citigroup in the Second Circuit or Lanphier in the 11th Circuit. It's the exact same analysis. This court has never uttered the words, we adopt the Mensch presumption. But in all of its cases, it's by and large held to those same principles. And so, and to answer your question is, at the end of the day, the presumption is a way to import an abuse of discretion standard. The question is, should you be reviewing the decisions in the context where a fiduciary is required to invest in company stock, should you be reviewing that decision deferentially, which is what we suggest should be done, or the way the Department of Labor says should be done, which is it should just be open season, you can conduct a hindsight analysis, and if you can find an expert later on, good enough. But that shouldn't be the standard. The reason the presumption exists is to test at the pleading stage whether you're ever going to, whether a plaintiff's ever going to be able to allege a plausible case that there was an abuse of discretion by the plan fiduciaries. And again, I would submit, Your Honors, it has to be something very severe in order to justify a fiduciary from deviating from the plan documents, because otherwise you are putting a fiduciary, as Judge Hamilton said, on the razor's edge.
We have is a 90% decline in stock price enough?
It's not a specific price decline, Your Honor. I don't think you can simply sit here and say, well, it's 80%, it's 90%. Very few cases have held that 50%, which is what you have here, and now you've heard plaintiffs' counsel say that's the right number. Very few cases have held 50% is enough. But in cases like Summers and Steinman, I think the court has provided guidance on what sort of things might be sufficient, or the case I think is the best example for Your Honors is Peabody. In Peabody, what you had is it was a privately held company. The stock in the plan was the participant's primary retirement asset. 95% of his assets were in that stock. Mm-hmm. And he had no choice but to remain in that stock. He was not allowed to get out. And the company experienced a regulatory change that basically made its business model unprofitable. The plan fiduciaries even said, you know, from that point forward, we were basically headed downhill. Well, when you have something that changes your business model so that it's never going to be profitable again, that's the sort of severe circumstance, I think, that might require a fiduciary to evaluate, okay, now am I at the point where it's prudent to still continue to have stock in the plan? But even if you look, Your Honor, footnote 7 in the Peabody case, even this court in Peabody said that's a very narrow holding, and the number of times mm-hmm. that fiduciaries are going to be able to predict the market.
Would that reasoning ever apply to a publicly traded company?
I think that you are going to have very rare circumstances where that's going to apply to a publicly traded company. I would submit, actually, Your Honor, that I think if you're looking for something that gets close, I think if you took the facts and files, the Sixth Circuit case that the plaintiffs and the Department of Labor rely on, mm-hmm. I think if you took the facts and file, those get a lot closer to what I think in a publicly traded scenario would be closer. But take a look at the facts in file. In file, you had the CEO of the company saying, you know, if we don't get this round of financing, I don't know if we're going to survive. You had people in the marketplace publicly predicting that GM stock was going to go bankrupt. That's a whale of a different case than what you have here, which is M&I stock went down like the rest of the market, and it was never a non-viable company. Nobody was predicting it was going to go bankrupt. There was no reason the fiduciary in this case should have said to themselves, oh, boy, you know what, we have an obligation to get rid of the stock. All that would have happened is we would have been left on the same razor's edge you raised before Judge Hamilton, which is if the stock had gone back up, if we would have sold at that one period when it was at 1150 and it had gone back up, we would have been sued for divesting. We would have been sued for failing to follow the plan documents.
It would have been a pretty easy case.
I don't know if it would have been a pretty
maybe you don't want to concede that, but I'll I think it would have been. But,
I hope we would be able to get out, but it wouldn't save the fiduciaries from having to go through discovery, and there wouldn't necessarily be any Mensch presumption in that case.
Was there a dividend cut? Didn't it go all the way down?
I think the dividend was cut. I don't recall, Judge.
Well, I thought I remembered maybe I'd written some other case, but it really went down to like quite a bit, because obviously some people remain invested in a stock that has decent dividend.
Yeah, but of course, if
and
there was a dividend cut,
and the basis of, and the, you know, the stock can fluctuate if the dividend remains the same, you know, they'll stay with it. But if a dividend cut, then that might be some reason for people to investors, outside investors, to bail out. Now, I don't know what that means internally.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, if there's dividend cut, it would obviously be part of a public filing. The public would know. It's not.
Well, sure, they know about it, but that's when they. I just wonder if that is an indication that there's a problem.
I don't think so. I mean, a dividend can be cut for a variety of reasons. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's some sort of long-term trouble with the company. Because remember, at the end of the day, we're talking about retirement investments. Company stock is one of the options, one of many options in this particular retirement plan. If an investor and the fiduciary should be having a long-term horizon, they shouldn't be trying to time the markets. If the fiduciaries conclude, look, there's still long-term potential in this stock, there's no reason they should be bailing out of the stock. But I would submit to Your Honors that if you look at a case like Peabody, there was no long-term investment horizon for the stock, and that's what made the stock imprudent. Or if you look at the file case, as I said, it's decided under different standards that the Sixth Circuit uses. But I think even under the Seventh Circuit standards, if you look at that, there you could make a case that there was no long-term potential in that stock. And by the way, the plan in that case didn't use long-term horizon as the standard. The plan actually said the fiduciaries were to consider divesting if there were short-term problems with the stock, which makes that case very different than what you have here. At the end of the day...
Before you get to that, can I just ask you a basic question here? Is this... I've seen them set up both ways. Is this a welfare benefit plan, like a thrift savings plan, or is this a pension plan under ERISA?
Well, there's two different types of plans under ERISA. There's welfare plans and then there's pension plans. Mm-hmm. And then, so this is a pension plan, to answer your direct question. There's two types of pension plans. There's defined benefit and defined contribution. Mm-hmm. This was a 401k that had an ESOP component, so it was a flavor of a defined contribution. So
the reason I'm asking is I had I had one of these cases a few years ago with a 401k that was set up as a welfare benefit plan.
Okay.
Was this the only retirement plan available to M&I employees?
Yes, but keep in mind, Your Honor, it wasn't this particular. We focused on the stock fund. This was only one of 22 options. But yes, this was their only plan.
Okay.
In hindsight, among those 22, was there one or two options that may have survived the real downturn in the market? In hindsight, would have been a great place to go if you were even internal, or do you know?
Was there a
treasury fund?
There was a money market fund, and I think there was also a stable value fund, although you know stable value funds got hit pretty hard in the recession. Mm-hmm. But I think there was a money market fund. If you were totally risk averse mm-hmm. and didn't want to take any risk at all with your stock, I think you could have tucked your money away there. But there were other diversified mutual funds in the plan that probably got beat up pretty badly. I don't know if to the same extent as Marshall and Isley stock, but you know, there was no running from what happened in 2008.
Does the fact that this was one of many options have any real legal effect on the operation of this presumption of prudence, or is it just part of the factual backdrop?
No, it actually does, Your Honor, because if you look at both in Summers and Steinman, what this court has on occasion hypothesized is ways that fiduciaries might have an obligation to divest from company stock. And they've looked at a couple of factors. One is whether there's a planned mandate to invest in company stock. But the other thing is, if you look at Steinman, there's a hypothetical. It's not the actual facts, but the judge creates the following hypothetical. What if this were the participant's principal retirement asset and that they were conscripted in the plan? They had no other option but to invest in this particular plan, and that those participants were only 18 months away from retirement. In Steinman, this court said that, you know, that might create a different scenario, because if you have a participant population that is, you know, 18 months away from retirement, maybe you want to make different decisions. But again, in both Steinman's and I think and also in Summers, this court has said that if you can create a diversified portfolio by other options that are available to you within the plan, that does make a difference, and a fiduciary should be able to tolerate greater risk, because at the end of the day, we want to be able to have retirement participants be able to diversify their assets, because the one thing we know for sure out of ERISA is employee stock funds, they're not diversified. They're exempt from the diversification requirements. So by their nature, they're risky. Okay? But that can't be enough to hold fiduciaries liable, because at the end of the day, it does matter if you have other places you can put your money, because if you can create a diversified portfolio, on only one portion of which is in a risky investment, you can continue to have a very diversified portfolio and your retirement savings aren't at risk. So I would, to answer your question, I do think it has significance, legal significance for this case. I think the fact that there are other investment options means that you're going to need something very severe in Marshall and Isley stock in order for fiduciaries to say, hey, we got to get out.
The Sixth Circuit has suggested recently that fiduciaries under ERISA may have an obligation to act on the basis of inside information, or perhaps not act in the sense of just not trading. I discussed that with Mr. Klein a little bit. Could you address why that is or is not an appropriate response to these problems?
A fiduciary should have no obligation to trade on inside information, Judge Hamilton.
How about just freezing the stopping new purchases?
Well, if you look in the complaint, I'll answer your question, but if you look in the complaint, the plaintiffs never pled that that was what we should have done. They never said, boy, you should have frozen purchases.
No, this is pleading.
Even if you assume that they had pled that, there is no insider information that's even alleged in this particular complaint. If you look at the complaint, everything that's in the complaint was publicly disclosed to the market. All they're doing is cobbling together the facts that were known afterwards using hindsight and saying, well, gee, you know, look at all these facts and these articles and a couple of analysts who said, you know, gee, we're downgrading Marshall and Isley stock. It's all based on hindsight. I don't even think there's a suggestion here that there was some sort of insider information. There were originally misrepresentation claims, but those haven't been appealed. So for purposes of Your Honor's evaluation, you shouldn't be assuming there were any misrepresentations, and the district court found that none had been viably pled. But I don't think fiduciaries should be given an incentive to trade on inside information. I'm sure the SEC wouldn't be happy about that. And as far as I know, there are very few cases that recognize an obligation to trade on insider information.
Can I just ask you, I meant to ask plaintiff's counsel and the Department of Labor this as well, but I realize I've been asking a lot of questions.
That's your prerogative.
Have any of these cases against ESOPs resulted in judgments on the merits for plaintiffs, not just overcoming a summary judgment motion or a motion to dismiss, but a judgment that puts money in the pockets of the participants?
I think the answer to your question, Judge, is that ones that went the full route all the way to a bench trial, I think the defendants have always prevailed. But that doesn't mean that there weren't substantial settlements in these cases. So,
sure.
And you know, being risk-averse, defendants won't always take these all the way to the limit. But I'm really only aware of three that I know of that went the full route, and each of those resulted in a judgment for the defendant.
Thank you.
I don't have anything further, but thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Klein, your time had expired, I think, but you can have 2 minutes to rebut.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a couple of quick points. Judge Mannion, in response to your question, there was a dividend cut from 32 cents to 1 cent. As far as the Pew case, this court did not hold anything regarding a presumption. The court in Pew found that the allegations didn't show that the defendants knew of the small circulation problem at two subsidiaries, and said if it had to reach the next level, it would find that the presumption, that it wasn't pled that the stock was imprudent because the problems amounted to 2% of 1 year's revenue. But more importantly, the question here is not just the price of the stock, but the risk. The district court found that the percentage of non-performing assets was the only thing that came close to hinting at threatened viability for M&I, and that's at A12, and it was citing to a Bloomberg, a Bloomberg News article, which said that the company's non-performing assets were over 5%, which was a level that was considered dangerous. And elsewhere in the complaint, we allege that the non-performing asset level was as high as 6% during the class period. And that was public, and there's no question that that presents an enhanced risk to the participants. And the participants continued to be exposed to that risk through holding and continued purchases. And I'll just note that as far as you know what you know, the allegations are, is the Eighth Circuit recognized in the Braden case, no matter how clever or diligent an ERISA plaintiff is, they simply don't have access to the information they would need to plead everything, to prove everything as opposed to pleading it on a complaint. And this court, similarly in Rogers and Harzewski, both of which companies faced lesser problems than Marshall and Ilsley faced here. One was a product problem, and the other was a bad quarter and an FCPA violation, I believe, remanded those, saying we need discovery to see what the fiduciaries knew and when they knew it and whether they should have protected or could have protected the plan participants. Finally, on the presumption, I see my time ran out. Can I finish? This court in Coleman, and that's 933 F second, and it's the penultimate paragraph of the opinion on page 552. Basically, the defendants there were making an argument that there was a definitional, one of the definitions in ERISA had an effect on the plan, and the court says that basically inferences from silence in ERISA are perilous. ERISA was a carefully considered statute, and that if Congress wanted to do something, there would probably be at least a record in the legislative history that it wanted to do that. You can scour the legislative history of ERISA. You won't find anything about a presumption. Congress said in A1D, you can follow the plan until the plan's not prudent, and then you can't follow the plan anymore. And to read otherwise into ERISA, I think, would be inconsistent with the penultimate paragraph of the Coleman opinion.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.